The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of Spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of
Mixtape Memories.
I'm Jenners.
I'm Matt Hartspade.
And we're here for a fun episode, just me and Matt today, talking about one-hit wonders from the aughts.
I am very excited. I feel like a lot of the 90s ones that we discussed, I mean, those songs I legitimately love, and I think a lot of them kind of crossed over into like the alt rock, modern rock, whatever kind of universe. But a lot of our picks today, I feel like, are more pop, R&B, not exclusively, but there's more one-hit wonders from that kind of bubble.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Maybe it was a sign of the times.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, in the beginning of the aughts, that's kind of what was going on in music. It was like a lot of pop and R&B kind of, you know, tinged, you know, pop as well. And it was just like that was the thing that was kind of really popular at the time. And then like a little bit after that, like indie rock kind of popped into the mainstream and began to get more and more popular. And like, you know, hipsters started, you know, going, you could find a hipster everywhere, not just Williamsburg.
Exactly. But what's funny, I think, like in the late 90s into the early 2000s was very much like TRL culture and kind of this resurgence of like unabashed mega pop with Britney, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys. But then it was kind of paired with like that terrible like nu metal nonsense. So like if you'd watch TRL, it would be like Britney at number 10, Limp Bizkit number 9, number 8 was Korn, and number 7 was you know, I Want It That Way. So it's kind of, it's a very interesting dichotomy. And then I feel like that, once that kind of fizzled, it kind of led its way to some other kind of pop stuff that wasn't as bubblegum.
Yeah, that's true. And I feel like also around that time, I feel like a lot that influenced music was like internet radio or like music that you could like stream, and those, like, you know, some of them are still around, like KEXP and KCRW, that kind of like really, you know, rose in popularity. And then I think also because like their programming, you know, but like you know, Woxie as well, we, you know, we had Shiv on previous episode, who's the music director there. And yeah, like the rise of Coachella and like music festivals like that really kind of contributed, I think, to certain, like, this genre of indie that kind of like became really popular, but then really kind of blew up, you know, from there. And now I don't even know if you, I mean, like, is indie rock still indie?
I don't even know. I feel like, honestly, I feel like the term indie rock, in my view, is kind of dead, because I kind of break it down at this point into two camps. Either something is mainstream or indie, period, regardless of the genre. So I don't know. I think in general, if you look at kind of the trend of music over the last 10 years, there's fewer and fewer rock bands, there's fewer and fewer rock singles. I mean, if you look at like the Billboard charts or what's nominated for a Grammy, it's like it's all pop at this point. You know, I think there are multiple reasons why that is, but I think people at this moment in time are kind of tired of rock shtick. I don't know. You know?
Yeah.
And honestly, very few bands from that alternative era like survived to present. I mean, there's a handful. It's like Foo Fighters, I guess the Chili Peppers. There are only a few. Everyone else, it's like it's done. You know?
Yeah. That's true. It's just not cool anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, we have a list of really fun one-hit wonders that we came up with to talk about on this episode. Some of them are, you know, good, you know, in a relative way.
Some of them are not good. Let's just be blunt. But I think what's funny is, like, for me, whereas, like, when we were discussing Harvey Danger the last episode, like, I legitimately could still sing along to that song and get very much in my feelings. And, like, I want to do karaoke. And I still think that's a classic 90s alt-rock song. Some of this stuff I look back on and it's just a total LOL. And I think that's also, you know, sometimes a good memory is attached to a laugh as well. So, like, there's stuff on here that is, I feel like, so cringy. It's almost camp and it's almost like comedy, you know?
Yeah. Do you think that it's because this kind of era and time, like, you know, online was kind of exploding and things were becoming more like viral? So, like, things that did get like a laugh tended to get passed around or circulated and people like have a laugh about it.
That's a great point. I agree. And I think with some of the stuff we're going to talk about today, there was a sense of some sort of viral moment that catapulted the song in one way or another.
Yeah, totally. Probably like MySpace, right?
Yeah. Well, like, MySpace, and then, you know, there's someone else on here that is just going to be so hilarious to discuss, who had an SNL moment that went haywire that we'll revisit. But that also went viral, like, in the very early days of YouTube, you know?
Yeah, YouTube as well, you know? Where and like just content in general became like a thing, you know. Do you want to pick one from the list to talk about?
Yes, I'm actually going to double it up for this one because both songs have the same title, even though they are very different from one another. But I feel like one kind of flows into the other. So these are both from the aughts. They are both by fierce black women. The first one I chose was Blue Cantrell, Oops, Hit 'Em Up Style. And the second one was Tweet, Oops, Oh My. So lots of oops going on and no Britney involved.
weird.
Right? With Blue Cantrell, I just feel like that song was such an ultimate, like, F you screwed me over, like, woman power. I just love, like, the tacky lyric of her taking his credit card after he cheated on her and going to Neiman Marcus on a shopping spree. That's amazing. And she brought her friends with her. It's so amazing. It's kind of, in a way, I feel like the parallel was like the pop, another song I love, also kind of a guilty pleasure, the pop country crossover song by Carrie Underwood, where she's like pissed off and she's destroying the guy's car. I forgot the name of, Before He Cheats.
Oh, right, yeah.
So I love this song. And then with Tweet, I feel like that is like the ultimate like self-love kind of song, along the lines of like Divinyls, I Touch Myself, Cyndi Lauper, Shebop, but a lot more of a 2000 spin on it. And it had Missy Elliott. So anyway, I'm rambling. But what are your memories of these two tracks?
You know, I feel like I never really knew what a Hit 'Em Up Style meant.
Does it mean something in particular?
I don't know, but I just never knew what it meant.
Okay.
You know, so I was thinking about it today. I was like, what is she even talking about? But I feel like you explained it, like, the story of, like, you know, like, a cheating dude and, like, she wants to kind of get revenge, I guess.
Yep.
And she's doing it in style.
Yep, exactly.
That's what it means.
You know, the song had a recent resurgence because it was featured on an episode of RuPaul's Drag Race this season. It was the lip sync song, and I had forgotten about this track for a long time, but it's such a power anthem to me. I kind of love it.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, like, it's a fun song. I feel like it didn't really like stand up for me. Stand the test of time, and you know, between the two, I would say that Tweet was probably, like, you know, I like that song a little better. I just love anything, you know, attached to Missy Elliott and Timbaland, and, like, you know, they, like, co-produced this album, I think, or one, you know, they were producers on this album, and it's just that the lyrics are the funny part for me.
She was eyeing her thighs. It is pretty bad. One thing I'll say, the production of the song, I think a lot of Timbaland stuff for me sounds very dated. Like if you kind of listen back to some of the Justin Timberlake stuff and even some of the Missy stuff. But I feel like this song in a weird way sounds current. Like I could almost, I feel like I wouldn't be surprised if FKA Twigs said that this was like a reference point. There's some sort of line there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it wasn't too bad. I mean, it's still silly as fuck.
Oh, yeah, it's silly.
Lyrics, but yeah, I like your explanation of it, though. It's like a modern day Divinyls. I touched myself. That's perfect.
I also think there's something funny about like just in the chorus where she's like, oops, there goes my skirt. There goes my shirt up over my head. Like it just flew off. I don't know. Something about it makes me giggle. You know?
Yeah, totally.
What about a pick from you?
Well, I'd say maybe, I guess we could talk, well, if we're talking about funny songs, let definitely like Tattoo, all the things she said.
Oh my God.
Oh my gosh. I mean, there was like this whole thing in the beginning, right? Where people were like, is this a gimmick? Like, are they just pretending to be like lesbians or like a couple? Because they were like, whatever, making out in the music video for the song, and I actually don't really know the answer to that.
I think for a long time they tried to play it off as if they were a couple, and then I think ultimately they were like, it was a shtick, we were acting, we're not lesbians. In fact, I think they're both married to men, so
yeah, honestly, it didn't even seem like they were that into kissing.
It seemed like so cringy and forced.
Yeah, just kept thinking like, oh, like probably some male dude, you know, on their team was like, you need to do this to be, you know, to be a hit.
You hit the nail on the head. I think it was definitely like a marketing tool, a gimmick, a shtick. And I think that they were expecting to have mega international success. In reality, this was pretty much the only hit. They also covered The Smiths' How Soon Is Now, which is amazing, amazingly awkward. But this was, yeah, like the big radio single, but it wasn't, I don't think it was as huge, and they didn't have as big a moment as maybe they were hoping. But, you know, when I was Googling them to see what the hell they're up to, they only broke up in like 2011. Yeah. So they kept this going for a bit.
Yeah, I don't know how, but I mean, I also I was reading they performed at the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics in like 2014.
I missed that.
Not that I watched the Olympics, but like, you know. It's funny because even though they didn't go on to like, yeah, mega stardom, they were the first Russian act to have a top 40 single. And they're still, well, at least according to Wikipedia, the highest placing on the Billboard Hot 100 for a Russian act. So, you know, in some ways they achieved some stuff, but, you know, still like just an LOL group for me. And you know, kind of like a sad Ace of Base or something like that.
Yeah, that's a good parallel.
What about you? What's another song you kind of thought?
Okay, so I don't think this is your favorite, but this is a very bad guilty pleasure. Ashley Simpson, Pieces of Me. So this was the SNL performance I was kind of teasing in the intro. I feel like most people recognize this song as the one from that SNL episode where the track was playing, but she wasn't singing, and it was a big controversy at the time.
Right.
And she kind of did like this little dance that was very uncomfortable. I feel like she got way too much shit for it because, I mean, let's be honest, Britney was lip syncing. Lip syncing was a thing. And I think the plan was for her to sing over it like so many pop stars do. But I think just the timing of the track playing too early and her not being ready, it just was, it went awry. But something about this song, it's so terrible because it's, you know, obviously they tried, this is Jessica Simpson's younger sister. They tried to paint her as like the mall punk, gothy, like emo girl, and you could tell it's obviously very put on. But something about this song for me is kind of along the lines of like a Kelly Clarkson like mega power ballad type of thing. I don't know, it's so bad that I kind of love it. And I actually was just listening to it before we pressed play or pressed record on this episode, and I was like, I don't care, this song is so terrible, but I love it.
You're right about it being terrible. I honestly, like, I couldn't remember this song. And, like, I didn't watch the SNL thing, but obviously I heard about it. I guess I just had no interest, you know? And when I don't have interest in something, I just, it's, like, blocked out of my memory or whatever. But, you know, so, but I listened to it just to see, if, like, do I know the song? And maybe I just don't know that I know the song, because that happens sometimes with, like, the more poppy stuff. And, no, I don't know the song at all. I don't like it. So, sorry.
That's fair.
Oh my god.
That's fair. It was pretty much the only track of hers that really got any traction. And then I guess now she's doing something with her husband, who is Diana Ross's son. And I think they make like cheesy romantic, like, I don't even know who the audience is really, but now they're that's what she's up to now. I think once she married into the Ross family, I don't think she really has to worry about, you know, money. Right. Let's she be honest here. So I think whatever. They're just having fun.
Must be nice. Yeah. I would love that.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick one from, like, I think, like, the indie world a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, as we said earlier, it was really a time where it's like kind of crossing over, and which was kind of a thing that kind of blew my mind. And picking The Rapture, House of Jealous Lovers. Mm-hmm. You know, they were like dance punk, and I remember like going to see them at Bowery Ballroom, and I don't know, just something about it was like felt very epic. Like I was like going into this like party that was happening and just being like lost, you know, in the crowd a little bit, and everyone's freaking out. And you know, it's also like funny to see like in, you know, indie rock dancing, you know, like people dancing in the crowd. Mm-hmm. And so that was like kind of a thing where like indie rock went from like, you know, gazing at your shoes to like actually kind of being energetic. And it's interesting to kind of like hear that they didn't like the band, like didn't like the song, you know. It was like co-produced by James Murphy and Tim Goldsworthy from DFA. And when they first heard it, when the band first heard it, and like Sub Pop heard it, which the band was on Sub Pop at the time, they both like didn't want to release it. Can you imagine?
I didn't realize
like,
that
it's a little crazy to like think about. And then the whole marketing plan really for the release was like get it to club DJs, which is so smart.
Yeah,
that's the kind of track it was, and it really like catapulted them. And you know, with its excessive use of cowbell.
Exactly. I mean, for me, I was listening to and playing The Rapture on my college radio station when the first EP came out, and they had a track on it. I can't recall if it's the title track, but the first track on the EP is called Out of the Races and Onto the Tracks, and I played that song constantly. It's a great track. I remember seeing them at the Black Cat in DC just before this album came out, just before Echoes came out, and they performed all of Echoes, and it was obviously more of like dancey, electronic themed. And I just remember being stunned because it was not what I was expecting, because the EP was more like garage rock. But that said, I was very into this album, and I definitely saw them a bunch of times when they performed this album. The album following this, I wasn't as into. But this is a great single from that time, and just like going out and dancing. And I would say it's within my like top 20 like early mid 2000 like indie dance staples. Yeah. You know,
I feel like it's a little bit iconic of that time, that sound, and so you know, I feel like I have to mention it.
it's a great track, and you know, it's interesting as we kind of, you know, delve into the idea of a one-hit wonder. Like part of me is like, wait, but The Rapture had lots of stuff. But you know what, at the end of the day, if you were to ask me, like, name as many Rapture songs as you can in 60 seconds, after House of Jealous Lovers, I could probably name two or three more and then kind of be stuck. Yeah. So they are essentially, you know, for all intents and purposes, a one-hit wonder. I mean, this was probably the only track of theirs that got played at the clubs, that got played on indie radio. You know what I mean? So essentially, that's, you know, this is maybe a bit of a left-stream example of a one-hit wonder, but still it qualifies.
What about you? What's another one that you want to talk about?
Oh, goodness. I feel like everything on my list is so cringy. I'm going to go back into something very cringy, and I am going to go to Andrew W.K., Party Hard. God, I just feel like he was such a douchebag. And I picked this song more so because I have a story around Andrew W.K. than anything else. The whole concept of Andrew W.K. and everything being party-related, every single song, every album title, all that nonsense, and his whole look with the white t-shirt and the blood. I mean, he definitely carved out a certain mystique around him, I guess. The music I just did not really enjoy. I remember seeing him live and I was like, what is, I don't know if he's taking himself seriously or not. I didn't know what to do. It was just, I was a little lost. And then, so my story is at South, okay. At one point in time, he was the spokesperson for, I don't know how to describe this product in a safer radio, safer podcast way, but I'll just say it. It was called Sexy Swipe, something like that. It was a product that was put out by, I want to say Tampax, and it was like for a woman to use pre-sex so that she's fresh and clean.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vagina.
It was like a baby wipe. Yeah. I want to say it was called, it might have even been called like Fresh and Sexy or something. Anyway, it was, I remember like Pitchfork was writing about it. I'm like, why is he this, what? Whatever. Then I was at South by Southwest and I got this was, I don't even know, 07, I don't know. I got an email from someone on this Fresh and Sexy Tampax team and they were like, do you want to get a free box of it and meet Andrew W.K.? What? And I said, of course I do, yes. Why are you reaching out to me about this product? And also like, so random. So I assumed it was going to be like a big press event where he like hawks this product and speaks in a press conference and asks questions and answers questions and all this nonsense. And I just assumed it was going to be kind of an orderly event and I wasn't the only person receiving this invitation.
Oh no.
So I show up there with my friend Britt. And we're waiting for other people to arrive and nobody's there. We're the only people that I was the only person that got the invite. I got a plus one. So
you're the only
there
one
was
that
like
said
a step
yes,
and repeat in everything. That's what it was. You're absolutely, that's what it was. I am going to include this photo in our social post because I definitely have a photo with Andrew W.K. while we're holding up the Fresh and Sexy Swipes. Anyway, I just figured that was such a random story. I had to include it. And Andrew W.K. apparently is still going strong. I went to his website. He's still selling bobbleheads and signed merch and cameos and
God,
everything else. So I do not know who his fan base is now, but yeah, that's my
They're
story.
They're all like people who used to party hard.
Exactly. Now it's sleep hard. They could have called the product panty hard. Well, that would have been funny. Or maybe that's like too risque. I don't know.
Either way, I wouldn't have bought it.
No, I don't know if people actually purchased this.
I love that they purchased you. what the hell? Yeah, I also was very confused about Andrew W.K. for a while. Like, you know, yeah, he's party hard, like, whatever. But then he would, like, try. I think sometimes he would act like he was, like, a performance artist to, like, try, you know, because it's like it's like weird. It was like lowbrow, but like he's trying to be highbrow, and like I don't know. And
you're absolutely right.
I thought that was like a little bit too much. It's like, no, dude, you're basically a little bit of a joke artist in a lot of ways. So I don't really know. It seemed like he took himself seriously, though. Do you know what I mean?
I think at the end of the day, he did take himself seriously, which is the problem. I feel like if he took the piss out of himself, then it wouldn't have been as cringy.
Like he's always trying to be intellectual and like, you know, speaking of things and like in a way where you're like, dude, you wrote a song called Party Hard. Like, it's not that.
Every single song title is party related.
Come on.
It's like, you're right, though, about the element of, like, I'm a performance artist. I mean, I could see what he was trying for, but for me, it wasn't a success.
It really, like, I always remember this one time, or I don't even remember what it was, but I feel like he was on some kind of interview or something, right? Some part of a variety show or something like that, where he wasn't, like, necessarily performing or whatever. he was just speaking or, you know, something. And then after the show was over, he just stood on stage, you know, like frozen, just like mm-hmm. for a really long time. And people were just like coming up and staring at him like he was a, you know, a sculpture or something. And I was like, what the fuck is this? just get off the stage.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it kind of reminds me, though, of, like, an artist that I want to talk about, The Darkness.
Yeah, go ahead.
I believe in a thing called love.
Oh, yes.
Yes. You know, I think they're, like, a band that also is kind of, like, funny in a way, like, a little bit of a laugh as well. You know, they're really good, though. Like, I don't know. There's just something, like, I was actually never that into them. Really, you know, I actually didn't hate this song, but I wasn't like, oh, The Darkness, they're awesome. Like, I never was like that. And then I saw them, like, much later, like, in 2016, they played Festival Supreme in LA. I was like, oh, man, they booked The Darkness? Why'd they book The Darkness? Isn't that, like, totally, like, 10 years ago? And, like, you know, they were actually pretty good. So I was like, I was, like, really impressed. I was like, he can still hit those notes. He can still jump around the stage. Like, I was like, okay. Bring that energy. And, like, you know, I feel like, I don't know, somebody who was booking bands over there, like, definitely was, like, a huge fan or something. Because, like, why else would you book The Darkness? I don't know.
I'm sure.
Maybe it was Tenacious D. You know, that's Tenacious D's, like, festival. Like, maybe they're Darkness fans, and that's why they were on the bill. Mm-hmm. Which kind of makes sense when you think about, like, Tenacious D, you know, they're a funny, you know, band because of Jack Black and all of that kind of stuff. So kind of making sense for me now. But I just love that there's just something charming about them and that made them likable, actually, when I saw them live. I really, like, dug the energy. Maybe that's mm-hmm. just an example of, like, how a band's live energy can, like, maybe kind of convince you to like them a little bit. And mm-hmm. I also think it's funny that this was, like, their third single from their album, so it wasn't, like, their first
yeah.
single. You know, usually it's, like, the first single that kind of hits, or maybe even sometimes the second, but this was a third single. So
mm-hmm. yeah, I wonder why that is, that the first two didn't have the success of
nobody
this
knows
one.
What they're called,
but
I don't know.
No, I wouldn't be able to tell you. I don't remember. I mean, I just remember, like, obviously, I mean, you could tell what their reference points are. I mean, all the glam rock stuff. You know, I mean, in a sense, you know, they were kind of bringing something back that nobody had brought back in a long time. So they kind of, like, figured out their own path. And this song is a really good, like, pop song. Like, you want to sing along. And it's also terribly cheesy, but it weirdly works. And, you know, I have never seen them live. I'm actually shocked that they were booked in 2016. Yeah. Like, to me, that's like, wow. I don't have much to add. I just remember, like, the hair, the outfits. For me, it was, like, really mm-hmm. kitschy, and it shouldn't have worked, yeah. but somehow it did.
Yeah. It was like the 80s, but in the aughts or something, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
What about you? What's another song you want to talk about?
Oh, goodness. How about Macy Gray,
okay,
I Try? Yeah. I kind of feel like she was heralded as, like, she was going to be this mega star. I remember, like, all the buzz around this song and that album, and she got, you know, all this Grammy attention, and then it just kind of fizzled. I actually saw her open for Santana in New Jersey. I was dragged to that show. But anyway, I think part of the reason, unfortunately, why her career hasn't taken off, in spite of her, like, I mean, she does have a one-of-a-kind voice. Whether you like it or not, nobody else has yeah. that kind of range and that kind of, mm-hmm. like, smoky quality, at least not living. I think she's difficult to work mm-hmm. with from everything I've heard, and I think that that has kind of stunted her career. In fact, there was a venue that I was working with that was considering booking her, and I guess just her reputation kind of follows her, and we wound up not going with it. And, I mean, I think it would have been cool to see her at this point, 20-plus years later,
yeah.
after the big hit. I don't know. I mean, I kind of, I enjoyed this song back in the day. I have no interest in ever hearing it again, but I feel like this was a very big hit of 2000.
Yeah, this was a huge hit. And I agree. Like, I think there was, like, all this hype around her. And then, I don't know, you just don't. Although I think people still respect her and stuff, because I still see, you know, like hear her name being thrown around here and there. I don't really have much to say about her, you know. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think about her too regularly.
Yeah, I mean, you know. Wanted to kind of pivot a little bit and talk about the Hives, who I love. And
oh my god, this is the Hives. I just want to say before you hop in that, like, they're just an amazing live act. So still good. Right.
You know, I saw them, I remember seeing them like at a festival in Spain, Benicassim, and they're just so charming and, like, you know, they're just so catchy and, like, everything that I would think, like, of, like, that would make a band cheesy, they just somehow pull off. Like, so.
Yeah.
I just love them so much. And I feel like Hate to Say I Told You So, it was just, like, such a, just like, you put it on and you just, like, can't help it. Like, it's still really good. It's still catchy as fuck. And, you know, still gets me going. Like, I love it.
I think a lot of their earlier tracks are super fun. I remember also really loving Main Offender. But in terms of, like, the big U.S. single, it definitely was Hate to Say I Told You So. You know, I think in a similar fashion to Andrew W.K. and some other acts at this time, the White Stripes, you were starting to see indie acts, like, in a certain uniform, so to speak. And that became more of a thing, which you hadn't seen really in a bit. I don't know, but yeah, the first time I saw them, I had just turned 21, and I saw them at Black Hat in D.C., and they played a 45-minute set. They actually had a clock, literally, like a gigantic clock, digital, on the stage, and they performed exactly for 45 minutes. When it started, Pele pressed, like, go, and then the set ended, like, the last guitar lick was when it hit zero, and they left. I was like, how did they time that so perfectly? It's crazy. But it was, like, a great show, and I think, you know, it's a strange thing to say, maybe, but, you know, it was the gig took place just a few days after my 21st birthday, and I just remember, like, that was the first gig I ever went to where I had a beer in my hand, you know? And it's a strange memory, but it was a really fun one to drink at.
Yeah, you know? Have to drink a beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we could touch on some, like, really quickly, like a little lightning round.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. The Donnas take it off. I feel like the Donnas were also really hyped to be, like, the next thing. All women, badass, kind of punk inspired, kind of poppy. And then it didn't really happen. But this was like their crossover MTV hit. And it was kind of badass, you know? I mean, I don't really think about them much. I don't listen to them. I haven't listened to them in almost 20 years. But I think this is a fun single.
No, all the same things, you know, they're cool looking, you know, they're called the Donnas. So it kind of reminded you of, like, the Ramones and, you know, they're girls and but they had, like, the, you know, the attitude of, like, Joan Jett or the Runaways, something like that. And then, like, just, like, catchy guitar hooks. Actually, the guitar on this track is, like, pretty good. It's not as simple as, like, the Ramones or something like that. It was pretty, like, complex. So I give it to them. I want to talk about Peaches real quickly. Fuck the Pain Away.
Oh my god, I still love Peaches to this day, but obviously this is, like, her forever most iconic song.
You know, maybe some wouldn't consider one hit wonder, but, like, this is her, like, you know, song. Like, I always think about her, this song with her, and, like, you know, this album, Teaches of Peaches. Like, I mean, it's just, like, it's, you know, so, like, bold, but, like, cool, and, like, you know, sexual, and just like a cool beat. And the song also was, like, never recorded in a studio. It was recorded live, which is, like,
amazing to me. It's the only, she had never performed the song live ever before. And then it just so happened that the sound person was recording it, I think, on cassette, and then was like, do you want a copy of this? She's like, yeah, I guess. If you listen to the song, if you listen very closely, at certain points you hear someone going, woohoo! And it's literally someone in the crowd, because there were like four people in the room. And the person who was capturing the audio it picked up the sound from the girl screaming, and it was so kept in the song.
I mean, she's amazing. If you ever have never seen her live, like, she is amazing.
Oh my God.
Like, when I saw her, the last time I saw her, it was like at Bumbershoot Festival in Seattle in 2015, and she played like the stadium there at Seattle Center, and like, geez, like, it was like crazy to watch because like, it's a giant stage. It was like this elaborate setup, and she was doing everything herself, which I guess like I didn't really like realize like that's what mm-hmm. she does, and she's just like mm-hmm. running up and down and like. Whatever, and like she specifically told everyone she needed to like run right after the show, and she had her luggage by the stage, and then like after the show you just see her like go to the luggage and like wave bye.
Amazing.
That was amazing.
I have seen her many times through the years. It's always incredible. She's otherworldly. She's incredible. And what I love about her shows, especially if you're in the front, you almost feel a sense of danger. Mm-hmm. Like you don't know what she's going to do. If she's going to, you know, I don't know. There's nothing predictable about a Peaches show. And I think that's what kind of adds so to cool. the magic of it all. The only other thing I'll say, I can go on and on about Peaches, but the only thing I'll say is that a couple years ago, I was working with an artist who was performing in Berlin, and he had invited Peaches to the performance. And she had never confirmed if she was going to come or not. And I was like, I hope she comes, blah, blah. And then because I was in the press row, she did come and she had a press ticket. We were sitting next to each other and I was losing my shit. Yeah. And I had to just say nothing, do nothing, pretend like I didn't know who it was. And I was like, oh my God, Peaches is sitting next to me. I was freaking out.
So many times.
And then actually.
Pretended not to know the person that? Standing next to you or sitting next to you. Just play it cool.
Yeah, I think we've all done that. I mean, one other quick memory is when I saw the Stills many, many years ago at Shinee. I was standing next to Paul Banks of Interpol, and at that point I was a mega Interpol fan, and I just had to, you know, yeah, totally. Play it off, you know. But yeah, Peaches, for anyone who's listening who has never seen Peaches, once everything reopens and she's tours again, you must see Peaches live. She's unbelievable.
What about you? Another quickie?
I think I'm just going to throw this one in, not because I enjoy the song, not because I think it's a quality song, but I think it was such a staple of the 2000s, and because you still hear the song on Light FM and in the elevator and at the laundromat and at the supermarket, is Vanessa Carlton.
Oh my God.
A Thousand Miles. Come on. You hear that piano riff, those first like 11 notes, and you're like, fucking Vanessa Carlton, A Thousand Miles.
Oh, no.
Did she ever make her way downtown? We don't know.
Oh my gosh. I don't have much to say about this song.
But I will say briefly that, like, I remember a moment in time when Vanessa Carlton and Michelle Branch were kind of like the Britney Christina.
Oh, my gosh. Michelle Branch. Like, that's who I was trying to think of. I was like, she was like part of like a bunch of, you know, girl singers, songwriters that were coming out and stuff.
Yeah.
Totally.
But they were definitely trying to like pit them against each other as like the dark haired 20 something singer songwriter, right. Or whatever. But. Anyway, I can't listen to either one of them. But this song somehow has survived the test of time. I mean, I feel like I still hear this song once every couple months somewhere.
It's a good one, you know. Not really. But
Speaking of not really, can we talk about the Bravery and Honest Mistake?
Yes, please.
Now, I know that we briefly touched upon this with the episode with Bill Paris from Brooklyn Vegan, but like, God, the Bravery were so hyped up to be this incredible act, and boy, were they stinky.
I mean, this is a prime example of like hype over substance and like style over substance.
God.
And, like, that's why they didn't really last. Although I see them on like, you know, if you think about indie one-hit wonders, I feel like they come up a lot in lists and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. An Honest Mistake, it says it all, right?
I'm sure this album is like somewhere in middle America in the 99-cent bin of a used CD store.
I also love, like, you know, not to talk about them too long, but like, I just love that they, I read that they promoted themselves on the internet as one of the first bands on MySpace. Like, Okay.
Well, that singer, I forget his name, that guy's look was so right out of a MySpace profile. Like, literally, like, he was like the archetype.
They were
like
the king of hairspray, you know, for sure.
God, was it bad?
I don't know. There's so many that I want to talk about. Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. Skin of My Yellow Country Teeth. Like, there was a point mm-hmm. where they were like, so huge, so popular. Like, everybody fucking loved them. You know what I mean?
I feel like they were one of the first bands that, like, the blogs really, really were clinging to. And then, you know, they had a career. I mean, that's what catapulted them for sure. They were never my thing because, like, his voice for me was very grating. But, I mean, this song was catchy enough. It was fine. I actually, in our little shared notes document, I see you mentioned the tour at the National. At the time, I was a big National fan, and I saw National Clap Your Hands. I saw that tour at Bowery Ballroom, and I was very into the National album Alligator. And at that particular show, they were flipping back and forth, like, who was headlining. At that particular show, Clap Your Hands were first and National were headlining. And there was so much buzz around Clap Your Hands. Like, I just remember 90% of the room left afterwards, and I just thought, y'all are missing. I mean, at that moment in time, I was a big National fan. Now, not so much, but, like, God, I never understood that, to leave before the headliner.
I mean, that's, you know, buzzworthy bands. That's what happened, you know, with, like, the flavor of the moment. But now I feel like if they were both on a bill, the National would headline. But I don't know. Maybe not. Who knows?
Oh, no, for sure. No, the National now is, like, huge, huge. I mean, I feel like over the last couple of years, they did shows at, like, Forest Hill Stadium here in New York, which holds a good 10,000 people, maybe more.
You're right.
It's crazy.
There's some leftover tracks here that I just want to hit really quickly because they're just so funny.
Go
Electric
for it.
Electric Six, Danger, High Voltage. Dude, I mean, I felt like they were a joke band. Were they not a joke band? Yeah.
I think they were. Didn't they also have a song called
Gay,
like,
Bar? Yeah, I met him at a gay bar. Gay Bar.
Yeah, okay.
But the...
I definitely saw them at Bowery Ballroom.
So, like,
back
there's
in the day.
An actual singer and stuff. Because, like, what was I reading? Like people were, like, kind of rumoring that Jack White was really the one who, like, did the vocals or something. I don't know. It's so weird.
Oh, I didn't hear that. Conspiracy theory.
I don't know. Maybe it's just, like, an unfortunate Wikipedia entry or something like that. I love that the New York Times called the song catchier than anything on the radio by the White Stripes, though. So it makes me think there was some kind of White Stripes connection. Maybe it's just because they're both from Detroit. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
Also, Weedus, Teenage Dirtbag. I mean,
that's a good song. I don't care.
No, yeah, it's a good song, but it's, like, funny, you know, and it's like, it's like the song everyone sings along to at karaoke night, you know? So good.
It's such a good karaoke song. I still think that's a fun song.
I don't care either. Really bad one, The Killers, Mr. Brightside. Dude.
Listen, I loved The Killers. I loved Hot Fuss, and then I hated them. But I loved Hot Fuss. And this song and Somebody Told Me, at the time, I thought were fucking amazing songs to go dancing to. The Killers now are, like, total cringe fest, and I would never, you'd have to pay me to see them. But at that moment in time in 2004, I thought both of those singles were amazing.
I don't remember that
amazing.
Second one, but
I'm not gonna lie.
I feel like I'm embarrassed to say that at the time I also really loved Mr. Brightside, and I don't know, it might just be that, like, because I met them, you know, I remember meeting them at Don Hills, like,
that's cool.
And I think it was through ASCAP. I used to work for ASCAP, so that was probably why I like them. But then, yeah, they became total, I don't know, just not good stuff. So,
no. Brandon Flowers at the beginning was kind of a cutie,
yeah,
I thought.
Creepy? I don't know. In a,
yeah. And well, he's Mormon,
that's
so
probably
that's
where
yeah.
it came from.
He has, like, seven kids now, I think. The Hanson kids, by the way, just very briefly, that the Hanson kids are all Mormon, and I think combined they have 21
what?
Kids. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
We can continue.
Too many kids. Okay, another kind of jokey band, Fanny Pack, Camel Toe. Yeah.
This was
I
fun.
I like this one.
Yeah.
I feel like it still, like, holds up in a way, just, like, as far as, like, having a fun song with, like, kind of a cool beat. I didn't actually realize this was, like, on Tommy Boy Records, though. Like, I was
that
like,
I had
what?
No idea.
It's actually a lot cooler than that. But But it reminds me of like those songs where, like, you know, it's kind of like they take like a funny thing and they turn it into a song, like Gillette. Remember Gillette, Short Man?
Yeah, it has that kind of vibe Gillette, to yes. it.
And I don't know. I thought this was a song. Maybe I made it up, but I thought there was a song called Somebody Farted, but I could not find it on Google.
Can I tell you, I saw that in your notes and I was busting. I was cracking up. What did you talk about?
I swear there was a song.
I don't remember that.
Somebody farted so hard they made a hole. And then they were like. They were like, oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. But oh, my honestly, God. I can't wait to Google this song somebody afterwards.
Farted, and like the first song that comes up is like very close to it, but it doesn't have all the lyrics that I remember.
Oh my God, my search engine and my cookies are going to be all fucked up after that one.
You can't search it on Spotify, though. Some weird shit comes up.
Okay, oh my God,
I think I'm
so
ready
funny.
To move on.
Okay. I think we should go into our little bit of like our deeper dive kind of sort of like mini repeat skip segment where we spend a little more time on select Sounds tracks good. From this era. Why don't you go
right,
first?
Right. Well, I'll start with like kind of an obvious one. Peter, Bjorn, and John, Young Folks.
Mm.
I know some people might think the song got overplayed, but I love it. And it's the one song that I like associate with them so much. And, you know, Peter Morin, like, I love his vocals. I still love the whistling. I love that the girl vocals are sung by Victoria Bergsman from The Concretes, because I also was a huge Concretes fan. And
yeah, me too.
I don't know. I just love everything about the song. It's catchy. It's fun. And it's got girl-boy vocals, which I love songs like that, that have that kind of interplay. And I met, actually, Peter through Doug Marvin from Dirty on Purpose. I think he would, like, tour manage them. And then when he was on the road with them, sometimes he would, like, if John wasn't able to make it, the drummer, he would, like, fill in for him. Or, like, he would go on stage and play bongos, which I thought was kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so that's kind of my Peter, Bjorn, and John Young Folks thing. Do you have any memories?
I mean, I definitely saw them back in the day. I just think this is a great indie pop single. I mean, I think it's as simple as that. It's just it has every element, like you were saying. The vocals are great. The whistling, it's catchy. It kind of uplifts your spirits. I think it's just a fun track, you know? I can't remember a single other song of Peter, Bjorn, and John, which I guess makes it the perfect candidate for this, you know? Although I know they had others, but this was definitely like the big standout
one. Everyone knows.
Yeah, they were fun. They were cute. I think it all worked.
What about you? What's your first deep dive?
Oh, goodness. The few that I chose for this section are all over the place. So I'm just going to go right into it. Let's do Kia, My Neck, My Back.
Oh, yeah. I love that
one. So I feel like this song, in a way, was the precursor to WAP, about a woman saying exactly what she wants in the bedroom, being completely unabashed about it. And to be honest, there are no metaphors here. It's like, it's very matter of fact. And to my knowledge, it's probably the first song that that mentions rimming in the chorus.
It? Oh my God. I remember that.
Yeah. So, I think to this day, you know, I was listening to it in preparation for this episode and I was like, ooh, I still feel like this song is kind of filthy, because it is filthy. Good for her. I mean, this song, in a weird way, I feel like is pretty legendary. And yeah, I mean, I love a sex positive song. And I mean, this is like textbook.
No, I mean, it was like really, it like really took off. Like, I feel like it was like one of those songs that like people would play, you know, for the sexy bits. But in a way, it made it like fun. Almost kind of in a fun way. Mm-hmm. So to me, like Kia, like this song, it's always like kind of done with like a little bit of a wink and a smile. Like when if you're like actually singing, like no one's singing it like seriously. You know what I mean? Like, you're singing it because you think it's kind of funny to like talk about this stuff. And but I like the way you framed it in that it was like an empowerment thing where it's like, yeah, we can talk about mm-hmm. this kind of stuff and there's nothing wrong with it and talking about what we want and all that stuff. So I feel like a lot of people identified to that vibe as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, back to you.
Well, piggyback off that a little bit and like maybe talk about LaRue Bulletproof. You know, I picked mm-hmm. this because I, at the time it came out, like I was really into it and just remember like listening to it a lot and singing along and stuff like that. But it just didn't hold up for me, to be honest, when listening back. And that was a little bit of a disappointment. Like, I don't know, for whatever reason in my head, it had like this epic quality to it, like Sia Chandelier or David Guetta Titanium. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's just something like really epic like that. But then I was mm-hmm. like listening back and I was like, it's actually not like that at all. Like not very cool. But I don't know, I think this like one press quote that I found kind of encapsulates I guess my feelings on it now. Someone called it the less creative imitation of the classic tunes created by 1980s groups including Depeche Mode, Erasure, and the Human League. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could see the Human League reference. I think for me, what I instantly think of is Eurythmics, actually. Mm. I remember there was a lot of buzz around her and Little Boots as well around this time. I saw LaRue at Highline Ballroom for the first time and she performed this whole album straight through. And I mean, I was into it. I mean, but, you know, in terms of the tracks that really crossed over, this was the one. And really, I was shocked when I started hearing it on pop radio because I always thought she was like this underground, cool, you know, European artist that, I don't know, I didn't think it was going to make sense next to Miley Cyrus on the radio, but somehow it did, and she really had a moment with this song. Yeah, I mean, I agree that it probably didn't stand the test of time. It was a fun song to dance to back in the day. And I, you know, I don't know if that's legitimately her look or if that was, like, what the label told her to do, but her little, like, you know, red faux hawk and her kind of, like, maybe that's why I think of Annie Lennox, like her kind of masculine way or androgynous way of presenting herself.
It definitely was like 80s retro geometric stuff that they were like pushing on.
Yeah. So much so, 80s reference.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I almost like wish like somebody like with a really good voice would like cover the song. Maybe they have. I don't know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I feel like the song itself like has potential, but the voice just didn't like hold up for me, like the vocals, for whatever reason.
I feel like if you actually think of the lyrics in the chorus, like this time maybe I'll be bulletproof, or next time I'll be bulletproof, it's kind of like a sad realization that like she keeps getting fucked over. And I feel like if someone were to cover this song in a very serious manner, like as a piano track or something, yeah, it might be kind of heartbreaking, actually,
and moving. You know, like it has the potential. I was actually reading that when they were coming up with that line, it was like, this time I'll be, and then the timing just like was never right every time they tried to like, you know, sing it over the track. And so they added the baby in between, like, this time baby I'll be. And then they were like so excited about that one word changing everything.
Okay. Because nobody uses baby in a pop song.
It's not that revolutionary. It's a filler word all the time.
Not really.
What about you? What's your next?
I think I'm just going to go for it. Paris Hilton, Stars Are Blind.
Oh, my gosh.
So she, you know, this was the only song of hers that did anything. And with, you know, this is a song, another song that should never have worked. But I think for some reason it did in a very guilty pleasure way. This song was originally written for Gwen Stefani, which makes sense because it totally sounds like kind of ska, you know, mid-2000s Gwen Stefani vibe. I guess Gwen turned it down and Paris Hilton was like, I guess I'll take it. And I don't know, something about this song is kind of like breezy, at the beach, I don't know, having a margarita, carefree. And I don't even really care that it's Paris Hilton and it's like total cringe. I think it's a fun little pop song. And what I didn't realize until literally this week is that the song has a very like kind of, I guess there's this new film out called Promising Young Woman, which I have not seen and honestly don't know the plot line. But apparently this song soundtracks a scene that is very pivotal to the film, and the song is having a bit of a resurgence right now. So,
honestly, I didn't even realize like Paris Hilton had an album. Like, I was like, she sang? I didn't know that. And then when I listened to this track, I was like, I definitely did not know about this song.
I think you had to be gay to know this song. No, I just feel like in a weird way, like it became like a song you'd hear at the gay bars. And I don't, because it was so ridiculous.
She was kind of at one point like the biggest like celebrity, non-celebrity, you know what I mean? Like socialite celebrity kind of, you know, at the time. And, you know, now there's like a whole documentary, you know, like talking about, you know, like some of the traumatic stuff she went through, and, you know, kind of just like what it was like for her to be in the public eye and just like dealing with paparazzi and also like parental, I guess, you know, disciplines that like, you know, maybe like people didn't really know about, and then having to go away and being like, I guess, in this some abusive like boarding school. But so actually like that did like humanize her for me, you know, in a lot of ways. And then like I recently saw like Sarah Silverman kind of apologize for like jokes she made at like MTV Awards or something like that. Because like Paris Hilton now has like a podcast where she like will talk about these things. And it is kind of interesting to, you know, I'm like making fun of the song, but yeah, like that was, she was like a big joke in a lot of ways. So maybe I shouldn't be ripping her too hard. But I mean, this song, actually, now that you say that it was written for Gwen Stefani, like, okay. Now it's like, okay. So somebody sold her on this. Like,
exactly. One other thing I just want to say about Paris Hilton is that I think for most of us, including me, you know, you think of Paris Hilton, you think socialite, you think maybe, I don't know, bubblehead, whatever you think. You think maybe she's kind of like had her moment in the aughts and now is kind of a joke. But you know what? Paris Hilton, seriously, has a gazillion brands when it comes to perfume, when it comes to beauty. And she was, I feel like, even though she was the butt of the joke there for a little bit, she really has made a fortune off of her name. And she's still, at least in Europe, maybe not so much in the US, and around the world, I feel, even outside of Europe, like a significant name when it comes to that kind of cosmetics universe.
I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, to know that like she was probably motivated to like get out of her the power hold that of like her parents' like fortune or whatever, and like be independent and not have to rely on these people who like just didn't let her do, you know, live her life, you know, the way she wanted. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's a good motivating factor. So yeah, you know, like she was kind of the first one to really do that, you know, like kind of, you know. And then like people like Kim Kardashian like followed suit and were like, I can be famous for just being famous and like whatever, like it's fine. Mm-hmm. Not to get off too track, I'll talk about Postal Service, Such Great Heights. I feel like they were part of that whole like Pacific Northwest, you know, explosion of like indie rock. Or I always associate them with that area, Seattle or Sub Pop. And to me, they're like quintessential aughts indie gone mainstream. I mean, the song, I feel like, became pretty huge. Mm-hmm. You know, I also love the Iron and Wine cover of the song that also came out in the aughts. Love Ben Gibbard's vocals. I think they're pretty cool, like unique. And when I was reading about this song where Ben is talking about the song and he says it's the first time he's ever written a positive love song where it's a song about being in love and how it's rad rather than having your heart broken. And I do feel like it has like a very uplifting vibe to it. Mm. So to me, this is like, it still holds up. I don't know. When I was listening to it, preparing for this episode, I still loved it. What about you?
I absolutely adore this Postal Service album, the only one they ever put out in terms of like a studio record, Give Up. I, to this day, kick myself that I didn't see them when they toured this originally, because I think that would have been magical. I always thought this was a great album, and I thought this is obviously such a great single, and like you said, kind of quintessential, you know, aughts indie. I did wind up seeing them when they quote-unquote reunited maybe 5 years ago, And it's so crazy because when they originally toured this release, they were playing, you know, 500 capacity rooms. And then when they did their reunion tour, they were playing multiple nights at basketball arenas. So it was kind of crazy. But I did see them at Barclays Center. Yeah. I know, it is wild. They played they played two nights. It's crazy. My friend Laura Byrne from the Minor Birds was their backing vocalist and keyboardist on this tour. And I said hi to her after the show. She got me I've never been backstage at like an arena before, which was weird. It felt like such an aughts indie moment because backstage were obviously Ben Gibbard, obviously Jenny, Rilo Kiley, Jenny Lewis, but also Connor Oberst was there. And I was like, this is strange to like be sharing cheese with these people. I don't know. I think that Postal Service album from start to finish is incredible. And I think this is a great song. And speaking of that cover, I am not an Iron and Wine fan, but I think that cover is stunning. I love that cover. It's just so simple. It takes the Postal Service version is obviously a lot more poppy, but I think when it's totally stripped down like that and with the Iron and Wine vocal that's
Sam
a little
Beam.
More like
I love his
deep
voice.
And
I don't care.
Harrowing, I think it's great. So, I mean, I'm glad you picked this song. I could talk about Postal Service forever.
I adore versions of the song, that the Postal Service and the Iron and Wine version, like over and over again. And it hits me differently. So I love that about them. All right, you're next.
Okay, I am going to pick Estelle, American Boy. I feel like I'm really choosing a lot of pop tonight, but I'm just kind of feeling it. And I feel like most of the stuff I gravitated to in the 2000s that was in the one hit wonder category, for some reason, were more pop and R&B. I feel like similarly to some of the other artists we discussed today, like Macy Gray, Estelle was really like super buzzed. And I think that she was on her way to like superstardom. And I got to say, this song was a gigantic hit all over the world. It's American Boy, which featured Kanye West, but we won't discuss him because he's obviously problematic and irritating. Well, I won't discuss him because I can't with him anymore. But Estelle, I mean, I think something about this song is so sweet. Just like, I just love that lyric where she's like, that she, you know, talking about she's never been to Brooklyn and she wants to kind of discover what he's about. And I don't know, something about it is very romantic and it has a really great beat. Yeah, I really dig her. I think maybe part of it why she didn't take off is because this song is kind of the anomaly. A lot of Estelle's music is a lot more muted, a lot more piano and like cabaret style. So if you have a big pop song like this, I think people are going to want you to have another big top 40 kind of bouncy track. And I don't think she had another one.
I don't actually know, you know? Anything else from her catalog. But like, yeah, this song was a huge hit. Like it's still... good. I mean, her vocals on it are really good. The music's really good. No complaints.
So I think we are nearing the close. We're each going to pick one more to discuss, and then we'll close the episode. So what's your final pick for tonight?
Okay, so maybe some would argue that the Shins are not a one-hit wonder band, but I think they are,
the shade.
I was a big Shins fan for a really long time, so that's why I think I have a notion that some people would say that they're not. But honestly, like, if you ask me to like name a Shins song now, like this is probably the only one I could like really name off the top of my head. New Slang, you know.
Same.
And for me, like, I really fell in love with them when I saw them at Siren Festival in 2002, which was, like, the second Siren Festival. Just thought they were so cool, really good songwriting, really cool songs, and they definitely, like, had this, like, fresh sound to me, you know, at the time. With that, like, slew of Portland, Oregon bands that came out, like, around the time and became popular, like, Decemberists and Modest Mouse and Sleater-Kinney, you know, who, like, Carrie Brownstein from Portlandia was in Sleater-Kinney, so... but they really kind of, I guess, went mainstream with Garden State soundtrack, when they were on the Garden State soundtrack in 2004. But the song originally came out in 2001 on their debut, Oh Inverted World. It's still kind of, like, you know, it's got, like, a cool sound to it still. I wouldn't say, like, I love it anymore, but I think it's just because I kind of fell out of love with the Shins and like James Mercer and all of that stuff. I don't know. I mean, he essentially replaced like his whole band. So I felt like they weren't the Shins anymore. Like he should have just like picked another band name, you know? Like I hate when lead singers are like, I am the band.
So, I mean, listen, I was for a hot second, I was into this album. I think this is a fun track. For me, it doesn't really stand the test of time, but I was into it. And yeah, obviously the Garden State soundtrack, it was such a pivotal part of that film. I don't know. For some reason, like to me, I just, as a person, as a front man, I just don't find James Mercer interesting at all. I don't know. I feel like after this record, I completely lost interest. Although I know that their following record received like some decent buzz. I don't know.
I feel like they became...
I don't have too much to say, really.
Still, like, kind of a funness. Like, there's some tracks, like, from before New Slang that I used to know. I mean, I knew people that, like, had worked with them, and so they would have access to, like, all these tracks and stuff from earlier days. And I remember, like, listening to one and being like, oh, this is, like, really fun, and actually, like, never would have thought this was, like, the Shins, really, like, the way it was, like, recorded. I mean, it almost sounded like a demo. Maybe it was. And so I feel like over time, maybe they got too serious or, like, too into, like, the song. I hate when songs are, like, too obviously into the songwriting or, like, I don't know. There's just, like, not... like a realness to them or something like that. They're trying too hard. And they just kind of like faded away, really, right?
I think so. I want to say that James Mercer had a project with Danger Mouse called, that I was not into at all. That wasn't my thing either. I don't know. This is one of those rare acts that like, I don't know. For me, it was all kind of boring. I don't know. I feel like that album, as much as I enjoyed it 20 years ago, like I have... no interest in returning to it. And I don't know. Just yeah, it is I what mean, it is, wait, you know?
Wasn't like...
I don't know.
What was... there's one One Hit Wonder from before that we didn't touch on. And was that also a Danger Mouse thing? Or yeah, it was. Gnarls Barkley, CeeLo Green, and Danger Mouse. I just had to mention it because you mentioned Danger Mouse. And I was like... wait.
Yeah.
Charles Barkley too. I don't know. I guess that was his thing, like pairing up with like singers and doing projects and stuff, huh? But I mean, their song "Crazy" was like a literal one-hit wonder because that was like the only album they released.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
And then it turned out that dude was like a sexual predator. So now that song is like dead forever.
You know, certain songs could just get tinged, like tarnished, or I should say, with like scandals like that.
But that, I mean, just quickly going back to that Gnarls Barkley track, that was a gigantic single. My God, that song was on pop radio, R&B radio, hip hop radio. Yeah, that was a gigantic single 15 years ago.
You know, and, you know, I would hear it all the time at karaoke too. That's a huge karaoke track. Sucks when you know, the actual person kind of ruins it with like their bullshit. What about your last track of the evening?
It's funny because in my head before we were recording, I was like, I'm gonna end with Paris Hilton, but for some reason I felt like talking about her earlier on, so I'm gonna end with Sam Sparrow, Black and Gold. I'm also, this is another one where I'm shocked that this was his only like hit single. For those who don't know Sam Sparrow, he is, I think he's still recording music, an Australian kind of like a disco pop R&B artist. I mean, if you listen, I feel like you kind of hear elements of various different genres from, you know, years and decades past. And something about this song I thought was really beautiful. It's like I mean, it's about like queer love and just made for the dance floor. And something about the production of it, it just feels very fresh. It's sexy. It's a sexy track. And I'm kind of bummed that he went nowhere after this. I, you know, when I was doing a little homework into this song, because I haven't thought about it in ages, I thought it was really funny that I wound up picking Estelle as well, because apparently when he came to BBC Radio 1 to perform Black and Gold at the peak of his fame, you know, they always make them do a cover at BBC Radio 1, and he did Estelle, American Boy. So I guess they were... you know, big hits, like, just literally around the same time, which is kind of funny.
I actually couldn't remember this song. I had to look it up. But I actually liked it. I thought it was kind of cool. It had, like, a really cool, like, bassy groove to it, which I appreciated. And then I thought maybe I have a vague memory of it, but I'm not like specific memories attached to it or anything like that. I don't know. I guess like during my indie rock days, I really wasn't having too many gay nights days. I wasn't like going to Limelight anymore, you know? So.
Oh my God, Limelight. You know, it's funny. I was in Chelsea fairly recently and I walked by the block that used to have Splash on it. And it just made me like think of, you know, I think just anytime you walk by a venue that is no longer there and is now replaced by something cringy like a gym, I don't know. For me, it kind of like it stings, you know, and I feel like this is, for example, one of the tracks I might have heard at Splash a million years ago or any of the gay bars or clubs, you know, in the late
2000s.
I'm
noticing that I have a severe lack of like, gay club anthems in my, you know, mental discography. Like, I'm just like, wait, I don't know that song. I don't remember that song.
Well, I think also, like, you know, we were going to gigs, and I think sometimes for me, like, a night out would be see X Buzz Band at Bowery and then go to a gay bar for a nightcap. So for me, a lot of stuff, I think that's why also I maybe have like some sort of knowledge of pop from this era, because even though I feel like my day job but my night job were two different things, but you know what I mean? Like I had a very intense knowledge of the indie universe, but then I also, you know, would go to the gay bar and dance to Kylie and Sam Sparrow and Britney and everything else and a lot of the stuff we discussed tonight. So for me, they kind of went hand in hand, even though they didn't really have any sort of connection
like
otherwise.
Yeah, my gay days were more like late 90s or like college days, and oftentimes ending up at a gay night and then being like, why am I here? Never gonna find a dude here.
I remember very early on when I would start going to like gay bars and gay nights, and like my good friends, my women friends, would come with me just because they like wanted to have a good time. And then, I mean, almost always it's like, it's fun for a bit, I think, if you're a woman there, and then it's kind of like everyone is there to hook up or make out and I'm just standing here, you know. At a certain point, I think Margaret Cho has a really funny joke where she's like, suddenly it reaches dick o'clock and then it's like done.
I mean, sometimes I hear like stories still, like of like my gay friends who like go out still to bars and party, and like they're like, and then this happened and then this happened. I'm like, oh my God, I don't think that I can handle that. I'm too old. Like, I just can't. You know, it just reminds, it's like that feeling of like, I never really went to like the hardcore gay bars, like where things get like really explicit, but like I have definitely had many uncomfortable nights at like the Boiler Room.
Well, back in the day, anyway,
and
it
also
could go down
that
road.
Few women there back in the late 90s, and like people just stare at you like, why are you here? Like, get out.
Exactly. And I never thought that was a good look. And honestly, to this day, you know, obviously in COVID era, I haven't been to a gay bar in a long time. I always preferred the bars in general, if they were gay or not gay, that were kind of mixed and like it wasn't as segregated. To me, that's kind of, it's cringy. And to be honest, my friends, it's a fairly even mix of men and women. In fact, if anything, I would say I lean toward having my whole life more women friends than men friends. So it's just kind of, I always thought that that was not a good look. You know, I was in that world for a bit because for a long time I worked at a queer publication specifically geared toward wealthy white gay men. Let's be perfectly honest here. And a lot of times we'd go to an event and it was just like very fit Chelsea white gay men with money. Yeah. And I was like, this is fucking boring, y'all, you know? But I think things have changed now in terms of just, I don't know. I think things are more mixed now in general.
And I feel
think
that, maybe, that's I mean, a good I don't thing. I'm not 100% on it, but it could be, you know, the rise of like RuPaul's Drag Race and just like way more like, straight white women being like huge fans and then like wanting to go to the clubs and like dance to all the same songs that they hear on the show and like hang out with like drag queens and like whatever, experience that like kind of gay culture, and how huge like pride has gotten, and I don't know, just like a lot of things in the mainstream culture that where it's like more accepted now, you know, and just like a lot more mainstream than it ever was. You know, even now with like, you know, Pose, like the TV show Pose, and like, you know, ballroom culture, and then
Love Pose.
You know, HBO Max's show Legendary, where it's like a ball competition, and like, I don't know, just like, just something about, I just love seeing stuff like that, and you know, really kind of telling the story of like how, what a struggle it's been, and even though we've come so far, there's still, you know, a lot of work to do. And what was that trans disclosure, the trans documentary? I mean, that was like,
Disclosure crazy. Was great.
There's so much stuff in that documentary that I didn't know about, and like, I felt really educated afterwards, and I don't know. I just hope that there, you know, is more understanding and it continues, and, you know.
Yeah, I think that's one good thing in general from, you know, if you look back at 15, 20 years ago, where things were more separated. I feel like maybe it's also because of the internet, let's be honest, like that things are more universal and more blended now in all facets, when it comes to fashion, when it comes to music, when it comes to visual art, performance art. I feel like, you know, even back in the day, if you look and you saw like a band had huge success in the UK, but nothing here, you don't see that as much anymore. And I think it's because, you know, because of streaming and whatnot, everything is kind of international. Nothing is really completely confined to a specific region or bubble, you know, so it's a good thing. I mean, if you look at the UK charts and the US charts, outside of a few songs, maybe, like, it's pretty similar, you know. And then if you look at the Italian charts and the French charts, it's all pretty similar, you know, with like Cardi B up there and Lil Nas X and whomever else, you know. It's funny to me because it was never like that back in the day.
Yeah, no, but, totally. It's a really good point. Yeah. Yeah, this was a fun kind of rewind back to like a little era.
Yeah.
Oh, so different
than 90s one-hit wonders, like, you know. For me, and maybe just because those were the happened to be the ages that I would live through each era, but I think something about being a teenager and, you know, and early 20s perhaps in the 90s, and then, you know, well within our 20s in the aughts, somehow I feel like it paired things well. Like, I don't know, like in the aughts, like the whole idea of going out and dancing and indie culture, gay culture, dance culture, and in the 90s, like for me being such a radio head, so to speak, like I don't know, I'm glad I was, all that to say, I'm glad I was a teenager in the 90s, and I'm glad I was having a lot of fun in my 20s and the aughts. Totally. I feel like it was the right time.
These were formative years, you know. I'm sure there was so much we didn't cover, but you know,
and
we covered a lot.
Oh, there's so much we really did cover a lot. We need to end the episode so we could listen to Vanessa Carlton on repeat. Thank you all for joining us for another episode of Mixtape Memories, and we will catch you on the flip side. Bye.